So how can we make this case? Well, one way we can do it is to point out to people that there's no essential difference between the embryos you once were and the adults you are today that would justify killing you at that earlier stage.
Arguments cannot be religious or non-religious. Arguments can either be valid or invalid, or sound or unsound.
The substance view is the idea that from when you come into existence at fertilization until you die naturally, you are the same individual at every point in your life. So if it is wrong to kill you now, it was wrong to kill you then.
Greetings and welcome to Pro-Life Thinking, a Life Training Institute podcast in which we will talk about the abortion issue and larger issues related to bioethics in a way that's winsome, reasonable, and persuasive. I'm your host, Clinton Wilcox. It's been a little while since I've uploaded an episode of the Pro-Life Thinking podcast. Things have just gotten incredibly busy over here over the last few weeks. I do have three episodes recorded that I hope to release soon, recorded with my co-hosts Aaron Brake and Nathan Apodaca. I just have to find the time to edit them for post-production. I should hopefully be able to get to those soon. Now, a couple of things going on in my personal life, which to give a little bit of an idea of why things have just gotten pretty crazy, pretty busy. I've actually just auditioned as a keyboardist for a Foreigner tribute band called Foreigner Unauthorized. I met with two of the guys yesterday to audition, and they liked what they heard. So I passed the first trial, and now I'm going to sit in on a rehearsal and see how things go from there. There's also one other person that they're considering, so it's not a sure thing for me, but I've been having to spend a lot of time rehearsing for that. Also, I've just had an article accepted in the journal Bioethics with two co-authors, Daniel Roger, who is a friend and co-worker in Life Training Institute, and Bruce Blackshaw, who is a friend and colleague of Daniel's. I don't think I've ever met him. We collaborated on this article. Now, Bioethics is one of the top five leading bioethics journals in the world, I'm given to understand. So it's pretty exciting to get published in that. I'll give more information as the date of publication gets closer. We're just doing some minor edits, and we have to resubmit it for publication. The topic of that article is infanticide. We're responding to a philosopher who critiqued the arguments of Christopher Kaiser in his book, The Ethics of Abortion. So this philosopher, whose name I'm probably going to butcher, Juna Rassanen, I believe he's Norwegian or something like that. I might be getting his nationality wrong. But anyway, he responded to Kaiser's arguments in his book, The Ethics of Abortion. And Rassanen is saying that Kaiser's response just is not persuasive. And so Daniel, Bruce, and I have responded to his arguments, showing that Rassanen has not actually refuted Kaiser's arguments. And so Kaiser's arguments against infanticide still stand. And so that's the general topic of our article. And I also have an article that's going to be published next year in Christian Research Journal, which I'm currently working on right now, composing that one. And that's my third one for them. And the topic of that article is going to be on creationism versus traducianism, which should not be confused with creationism versus evolution. This is in regards to how does the soul get created when the human being comes to be at fertilization. Is it created with the human being at fertilization, or is it passed down sort of spiritually as the genetic material is passed down physically? That's kind of an in-house debate amongst Christians, and so it probably won't hold much interest to those who are not religious, or maybe even to those who are religious but not Christian, but maybe it will, because it's not specifically, not necessarily a specifically Christian argument, but someone who's religious and also believes in God might actually find the discussion compelling and interesting as well. So anyway, those are just some of the things I've had going on in my personal life, and things should be slowing down here pretty soon, and so I hope to be able to get back to those three episodes that I still have, edit them for post-production, and then start recording some brand new content as well. So hopefully look for those coming up pretty soon. Now, the guest that I have joining me today is my friend and one of my pro-life mentors, Stephen Wagner. Steve Wagner is the executive director of Justice for All. He has spent hundreds of hours interacting with abortion choice advocates on over 50 university campuses in the United States and Canada. Frustrated by shallow stereotypes and disrespectful activism, he passionately works to build common ground in the seemingly endless abortion debate and make a reasonable and clear case for the pro-life position. He has debated professors at the University of Toronto and California State University and regularly trained students at the Focus Leadership Institute of Focus on the Family for 7 years. Steve is the author of Common Ground Without Compromise, 25 Questions to Create Dialogue on Abortion in 2008, and he contributed to Apologetics for a New Generation in 2009 and the Youth Apologetics Study Bible in 2010. A native Californian, Steve now resides with his wife, Rebecca, and their four children in Washington, D.C. In his spare time, Steve enjoys good coffee and conversation, marveling at the improvisations of his kids, writing songs, living in community, and thinking of ways to surprise people. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, Clinton. Great to be with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on. We're going to be recording this show live, and so I'm going to be interacting with Steve for about a half hour or so, and then I'll open it up to callers. If there are no callers, I'll continue on with my questions. But if you have a question for Steve, you can call in at 646-668-8597. Once again, that number to call in is 646-668-8597. Steve, there's kind of a question I like to ask all of my guests, just kind of a way to get to know you a little bit. How did you become pro-life?
Well, I think I think I've always been pro-life. I came from a pro-life family, and probably one of my earliest memories have to do with my brothers and sisters being born. So I watched my sister being born, and then two of my brothers, and I was actually present for the brother just next to me. We have seven kids in our family. So the brother that came after me, I was three or two and a half when he was born. And I was present then, but I don't remember it. But I do remember the other births that I attended. And I think that is maybe an illustration of the kind of family I grew up in. Thinking about unborn children was very natural for us. We were welcoming the child into our family well before birth. And so I think that's probably how I became pro-life. My parents were always teaching our family about the value of every human being, and including children in the womb. And my parents really lived that out, not just talked about it, they lived it in how they served their family. So that's probably how I became pro-life.
It was pretty well modeled to you by your parents then?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say they lived it out in how they served their kids and people around them. As we grew older, we had conversations about abortion in our home. I would say when I was a teenager, and I began to defend my pro-life views to people in at my high school. I remember a drive with one of my high school friends going back to college and talking about abortion in that context. And so I think I was thinking about reasons for the pro-life position at that time. But I really didn't have a good idea of how to make my arguments persuasive or helpful to the person that I was talking to at that time.
Could you tell us a little bit about Justice for All?
Sure. Justice for All is an organization that is passionate about creating a different kind of conversation, one where pro-choice advocates want to think about whether their position is true or not, where they enter into a sort of dialogue where they can rethink things in a safe kind of environment. And when I say a different kind of conversation, I mean partly that it's a conversation with someone who disagrees with me. A lot of times, as pro-life advocates, we talk to people who agree with us, and we talk to more people who agree with us, and some people call that an echo chamber. I think that is a part of the pro-life movement. But I'd say at Justice for All, we want to go find people who disagree and try to create a different kind of conversation with them. And then it's a second passion of ours, what we like to call a twin passion, to train a different kind of advocate, a person who is winsome, who it embodies a set of skills that really come alongside the other person, partner with them in hopes of finding truth together. So that's what Justice for All is all about, is training pro-life advocates. Many times we're training Christians, but not always, to create a different kind of conversation, really in hope of creating a different kind of world where abortion is unthinkable, just as unthinkable as slavery, and where we have an affection for unborn children and women and men in distress and those who are different from us.
You train pro-life people to make this case, and you do that through seminars. You take yourself and others who work for JFA out to different cities to give seminars to pro-life people. And about how often do you do these seminars?
That's right. So we will do workshops and seminars, and we do a number of these each month in different parts of the country. But we really like to couple any sort of presentation or seminar or workshop event that we do with an outreach event where we can invite the people who came to the seminar to come along with us and at least listen into conversations, real conversations with people who disagree, at least listen in, but hopefully have their own conversations. For us, we want people to gain a new set of skills, the skills of dialogue. And the only way you can gain new skills like that is through actually practicing. And so we practice in the seminar. Our seminar is very interactive. And then we practice together out in a college campus environment, usually, where we create conversations with people through some sort of dialogue tool. For us, we use pool tables and big exhibits to try to help people have a reason to stop and talk to us. I've really enjoyed working with you, Clinton, out at those events. So I'm hoping that we can do that again soon.
Yeah, me too. Definitely, if they're out in California, you'll most likely see me. If they're not in California, you may or may not. It depends on if I'm needed or if they have enough people. But at any rate, whether I'm there or not, I would greatly encourage everyone to check out JFA and to attend these seminars if you are able. That's basically where I got my start, was with Justice for All and going through the seminar about three times before I started getting trained as a mentor for JFA. So I definitely am fully in support of JFA, and I would encourage everyone to check them out and attend a seminar if you can.
And Clinton, I'm curious how the outreach, what happened at your first outreach event? How did that go for you? Did you just listen in, or did you jump into conversations with people?
This was many moons ago. I don't remember specifically. Probably what happened is I just listened in for the most part, because I tend to be a bit on the shyer side, especially in person talking to people that I don't know. So I probably listened in more than I talked, but I'm sure I got involved in some conversations.
And since then, you've been to many events with us. And what's your experience been like?
You mean as far as mentoring or?
Well, just, yeah, in conversations with people out on campus.
I've never really been the greatest conversationalist, you know, talking to on a podcast. I'm talking to, basically talking to people that I know, or, like a single guest that I talk to who's elsewhere, talking to them over a long distance. But when it comes to actually talking to them out on campus, going through JFA has definitely increased my bravery. Isn't exactly the right word for it. More of, I guess, my confidence would be a better word in talking to people, because JFA, they have these ideas, these things that they train you about regarding common ground and being a good ambassador and these kinds of things. But the skills that they teach you as far as having a conversation will greatly increase your confidence as well. So it's not just learning the material and the arguments so that you're confident that you can have a good response to these people, but it's also just having these conversations and learning these conversational tools will greatly increase your confidence as far as just starting conversations and having conversations. Because often I find that despite the fact that I'm not the greatest conversationalist, people will still say that they enjoyed the conversation with me when all I was really doing is just asking questions for the most part.
Well, what I love about working with you, Clinton, is even though you describe yourself as a shyer sort of personality, even though that's how you are naturally, you work hard at starting conversations with people and engaging them in conversation because you really care about them. And it's such a model, I think, for all pro-life advocates to sort of get outside of ourselves and our own natural inclinations to try to reach out to someone who's different and try to make a difference in their life.
That's, you know, one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on. You and Josh Brom, who's really my first pro-life mentor, have really been instrumental in making me a better pro-life advocate. And so I wanted to not just advertise for JFA, even though I do want to do that, but also just to kind of hear in your own words some of these ideas and how they can improve our conversations as well. One of the main things that JFA teaches is about finding common ground with people. In your own words, what does it mean to find common ground with someone that you disagree with?
So I think of common ground as, on the one hand, it's an attitude, and on the other hand, it might be specific propositions or just sentences, areas of agreement with the person. When I say it's an attitude, the idea of finding common ground, seeing in the other person something that's like me, identifying with the other person, empathizing with the other person's beliefs or their concerns, that really is something I try to let infuse the entire conversation, every minute of every conversation. So there's this attitude that this is a human being just like me. We have common ground in who we are. We're both human beings. We both have limited knowledge. We both believe false things. So sometimes I reflect on the fact that this person I'm talking to who believes that abortion should be legal believes something that I think is false. I think I have good reasons to believe it's false. But then I look in the mirror and I say, well, I also believe many false things. It looks like we're in the same boat. And that takes me from a posture of I've got to change this person's mind, or I get angry because they have a different perspective. How can they believe in killing babies? You know, this sort of thing. And I change my posture to be shoulder to shoulder with them. We're on the same, really even on the same team. We're both humans. We're both trying to get more true beliefs and fewer false ones. And so we're working on this project now together. And so I bring that attitude into every minute of every conversation, or at least that's my aim. I'm certainly not perfect at this. And one way that our listeners can grow in developing that attitude or that character is by just picking out specific things and asking the person about them in hopes of finding common ground. So those would just be little bits of agreement anywhere in the conversation. If the person says anything that I can agree with, I try to call that out. I try to say, yeah, I think you're right about that. And I spend a lot of time early in a conversation picking those things out. I don't spend a lot of time early in the conversation trying to change the person's mind, partly because that's, I think, what I prefer. You know, I want people to try to understand me. And I've found that when I try to find common ground with people, that's a great tool for understanding what they meant when they said they were pro-choice, for example.
So your book is called Common Ground Without Compromise, and we'll get to it in a few minutes here. But what would you say is the difference between finding common ground with someone and compromising with that person?
Well, I think I can give an example of what compromise would look like. One of our volunteers came out to an outreach once, and I heard about a conversation this volunteer had, or maybe I overheard it. I can't remember. It was a while back now. But this volunteer, this volunteer is pro-life, believes abortion should not be legal, and is talking to someone who's pro-choice, and the person says, you know, I think abortion should be legal, and I don't remember what the reason was, but let's just say they said because of poverty. Well, this pro-life volunteer, very well-meaning, well-intentioned, said, well, I agree that I agree poverty is really difficult. I agree with you. And I think the implication in the conversation was she agreed that abortion should be legal. And so it's really important that she be careful not to just agree with everything the person's saying, because she doesn't genuinely agree that abortion should be legal for that reason. Go ahead.
I don't know. I just said I was just kind of indicating that I'm tracking with you.
Yeah. So there's really compromising would just be affirming things that we don't agree with. And this is an approach to common ground that's been, I guess, common in certain circles. So if someone says, look, we just need to agree to disagree, we're going to find common ground on preventing pregnancy. So we're going to talk about abortion, and here's how we're going to talk about it. We're going to focus on preventing pregnancy. So that many times for pro-choice advocates means let's talk about how birth control and condoms are the solution to all of these problems, pregnancy, unplanned pregnancy, abortion. If I leave the conversation there and that's all I talk about, well, I think that's an act of compromise for me. I can talk about that for a little while. I don't mind talking about preventing pregnancy. I agree. We should talk about how to prevent pregnancy, especially maybe with something that would actually work, like self-control. I want to talk about that. If that's all I talk about, I'm leaving the unborn child out of the conversation completely, as if they were not real human beings, as if they were not being killed 2,500 times today in America. Yeah. And that would be compromising. So somehow we have to find common ground, little points of agreement, maybe big points of agreement, without leaving out this whole other part of our perspective that's really important, especially in this conversation, which would be the question, what is the unborn? Mm-hmm. So I think that would be one way to compromise. I think another way to compromise would be to leave out the woman as if she were not a human being, as if she didn't have the same rights and value that we think the unborn child has. I think another way of compromise would be to leave out the person I'm talking to and treat them as a less than human, but actually they are a real human, just like the unborn child. So somehow we have to balance our love or integrate our love for each of these groups of people, the unborn child, the woman and who's considering abortion, the person that we're talking to. Somehow we have to integrate our love for all of those people at the same time, at every moment of every conversation. And if we don't, I think there's an element of compromise. So many times I've seen people just agree and stop there. So that's a much easier conversation, right? There's no disagreement, right? So we don't have to have the discomfort of not understanding the person, of thinking that they, you know, maybe thinking they're crazy or whatever. Mm. Those are messy parts of a conversation where you discuss disagreements.
Yeah.
And I think those are really important, important parts of the conversation. We can't just stop and say, look, we agree that late-term abortion is wrong, and that's good enough. Well, it turns out there aren't that many late-term abortions. They are important to talk about to a point, But what about abortions at, early in the first trimester, the most common abortions? I want to talk about those, because if I don't, I'm, again, treating the unborn child as if he or she is not really a human being.
You mentioned talking about things like contraception, and another argument that I've noticed a lot of pro-choice people making recently, and even some pro-life people have seemed to be, I guess, kind of compromising in that way, in which they feel that they should accept the premise of the pro-choice person, is they'll say something like, you know, you're just anti-abortion, you're not pro-life. If you were pro-life, you would be against capital punishment, you'd be for welfare, you'd agree with me on all of these other pet issues that I have, which seems like a way to try and get the focus of pro-life people off of the unborn as a way to lessen the impact. And I think that some pro-life people have kind of been falling for that as well.
I think that's right. And I think there's a tendency of some pro-life advocates to want to argue about all of these things. A classic case would be overpopulation. Person brings up overpopulation or environmental impacts of humans all over the world. And pro-life advocates sometimes are concerned about those issues, and they want to then debate it. Well, no, the world really isn't overpopulated. I mean, look, you know, and they'll bring up some example of some place in the world that's not, doesn't seem to have much population. And of course that misses the point of what the person usually is bringing up. And I think we need to avoid that impulse to want to argue about everything. At least not, you know, I mean, we need to treat different ones of these issues as more important or less important. And so with overpopulation, what we encourage people to do is just agree for the sake of the argument. Mm. We're not telling them to change, to compromise or to say, I agree with you if they don't actually agree that the world's overpopulated. But let's just agree for the sake of the argument that one classic version of the overpopulation argument is true, that there isn't enough food in the world to feed all the people. And if we have a million more people in America each year, we can't feed them. Instead of saying, you know, making what might be a good argument, no, I think we do have enough food to feed the people, and maybe bringing out a journal article about how we do have enough food, that might be important in a debate. But in a conversation where I'm one-on-one with someone, I'm just going to say, well, let's just assume that you're right about that. Let me agree with you for the sake of the argument. And then we can get back to the issue at hand. I can say, oh, let's agree for the sake of the argument that we don't have enough food to feed people. Imagine I had a 2-year-old here. Can we kill him because we don't have enough food to feed him? And that, of course, you know, the response is generally going to be, no, we can't kill the 2-year-old. And I'm going to ask a sort of a stupid question. Well, why can't we kill the 2-year-old? I think I know your answer, but I want to see if we agree. Is it because they're human beings? Well, then that's the issue. Is the unborn a human being like this 2-year-old? If we don't have enough food to feed everyone, that's not a good reason to kill a real bona fide human being. So
yeah,
that's
and
one
then,
way that we get we don't spend our time on some of these other issues. So capital punishment you brought up, it's an important issue. But the way I've found common ground with people on capital punishment is to try to get to the bottom of why they think it's wrong to why they think capital punishment is wrong. And in many cases, pro-choice people who are against capital punishment are against it because they believe it's being used to kill innocent people. Now, that's something that I can agree with. I don't think we should use capital punishment to kill innocent people. And in fact, I don't know anybody who believes that. So that's one way that you can kind of focus in on this. Again, the issue, is it killing an innocent human being? That helps me to get back to the question, what is the unborn, rather than get stuck on another another topic.
Yeah, and so That's not to say that these other topics aren't important to discuss, but in the context of an abortion discussion, they just serve as a distraction, something to get us off the topic. And so we need to bring that conversation back on topic, which is when we would use the trot out the toddler tool, as you just described.
Yeah, I think so.
I think you touched on this a little bit earlier, but just so we highlight it, why is finding common ground with pro-choice people so important?
Well, there's a practical reason that it's important, that it helps the conversation to go better, helps the person that I'm talking to be more open to my arguments, helps them to want to talk to me rather than to just want to get out of there, which I think is sometimes a pro-choice person's attitude towards the pro-life person. Those are all practical benefits of using common ground. But I think there's maybe a more important reason to find common ground. It's more, you might say, intrinsic to, or maybe a principled reason, I guess I would say. And that is, it's the right thing to do, or it's honest. Look, when I look at this other person, I think it's important for me to treat them as the sort of being that they are. They're a human being. They deserve a certain kind of respect from me. They deserve that as a part of their nature. They were built with a certain kind of, they were created with a certain kind of value that I need to respect. I think we are both rational beings that should take seriously the other person's reasons, take seriously what the other person is trying to communicate with their language. And so I think the principled reason of common ground helps us to do that, I guess, helps us to treat this person as a real human being. I think I think it also helps us to express our love for the truth. And I think we should love the truth even if it's inconvenient, even if it's inconvenient to our argument. Many times I have said to people in our outreach events that I don't have a natural affection for the unborn child at implantation. And we even show a picture of what that looks like, even though it's a bit inconvenient for our argument. The embryo at implantation looks like an orange with fungus on it. Now, it is not actually an orange with fungus on it, and we shouldn't treat it the way we treat oranges that have fungus on them. We throw them in the trash, right? Or we throw them in the compost pile. We shouldn't treat embryos at implantation like that, because our visual senses are deceiving us, or our natural affections are deceiving us about what this embryo actually is, which is a human being with the same value that we have. But I've said to people many times, look at this embryo. I don't have a natural affection for it, but the facts compel me to try to bring my natural affections into line with those facts. But I think that's an important moment for the conversation. It shows the person, and it shows me, that I care more about the truth than winning a debate or winning the person over to the pro-life position or any of those things.
So what are some areas then that pro-life and pro-choice people can find common ground on? Because it seems like the abortion issue, you know, often when we have these discussions, it can kind of seem insurmountable because it often causes people to get angry, to get upset, especially if we're talking to someone who's had an abortion in her past, or maybe a man who took a woman in for one. And so considering that it's such a heated discussion, what are some areas that we can find common ground on with pro-choice people?
Well, it's a great question. And the first area that I would like to suggest is that some reasons for abortion are understandable. So, and some are maybe more understandable than others. But when someone says that women, a woman is, who's in poverty is in a really difficult place, and for them it seems like abortion is justified or is okay, I think it's important for us to take a moment and say, I really agree with you. Being confronted by an unplanned pregnancy when you're maybe even too poor to care for yourself is really difficult. That's painful. I don't know if I understand what that feels like. You know, all of those statements are an important way of saying, I agree with you, and finding common ground. Now notice, this is giving voice to something that might feel like it's more of a pro-choice leaning kind of thing. I'm okay with that. And I think it's important that when we talk about common ground, we don't just see it as a tool of pro-life people to get pro-choice people to be against more abortions. There is a place for common ground on late-term abortion, right? Most people think it should not be legal. And that's a pro-life sort of approach to abortion, right? People would say that's a pro-life perspective. But yeah. I think it's important for us to realize that common ground is not just us pro-life people expecting pro-choice people to agree with things that we believe. Agree with abortions that I think are bad. Agree with all the abortions that I think are bad. Oh, now you agree with all of them, that all abortions through all 9 months are bad, let's say. Well, that's not all of the common ground that I'm talking about, because I believe the pro-choice person should also not be expected to compromise in order to have the conversation, in order to start the conversation, etc. So they shouldn't have to just give up their pro-choice perspective just to even enter the conversation or be a part of it with me. They should be able to we need to respect their need to find common ground without compromise as well. So really this idea of common ground without compromise has to go both directions. So when I say I think that it's understandable that someone would want to get an abortion if they were poor, it's not going to be hard for the pro-choice person to agree with that, because that's really their perspective. You know, then they're going to be more open to me trying to find common ground on something that maybe seems like more of a pro-life kind of concern. Something like, you know, late-term abortion should not be legal. They will feel like it's more of a level playing field then.
Part of finding common ground with pro-choice people also includes using the terms they prefer, correct? So, for example, calling them pro-choice instead of calling them pro-death or anti-life, things like that.
Yeah, I think that's so important. What we've found in just hundreds of conversations, our staff over the years have had thousands of conversations with pro-choice people, and we've found that if we can just use their terminology, it just makes the conversation so much easier. We prefer to use the term unborn for the child. I know some of my friends prefer to use the term preborn. I think, you know, we could have discussion about which is preferable, but the more that we talk about the unborn child as if he or she is a child, as if he or she is a he or she, as if this is a real human being, it's going to feel like a trick. It's going to feel like we're stacking the deck to a lot of pro-choice people. And that's why we use more neutral terms like unborn early in the conversation. Now, once I've made a case that the unborn is a living human organism, and all living human organisms, I think call a human being, well, then we might ascribe more human terms to the unborn, because we've demonstrated that, and let's just say we've gotten agreement from the person that this, the unborn is a living human organism or is a human being, well, then there's no problem with calling the unborn a he or she and that sort of thing. But early in the conversation, I want to use a term that's not going to put an unnecessary roadblock or stumbling block in the person's way.
And so that also includes using scientific terms like embryo and fetus, as opposed to terms like you were saying, terms like preborn, or even terms like baby or child, whereas we would say it's correct terminology to call an unborn baby a baby, because any pregnant woman, right, when she's not talking about abortion, is going to say she's with child, or she's going to refer to her fetus,
right,
as her baby. But in the
right,
context of abortion discussions, you prefer to use the more scientific terms, again, so that it doesn't seem like we're trying to stack the deck or use overly emotional language. Is that correct?
That's right. No, that's right. And embryo and fetus don't have the people don't think that we're, trying to get traction in the conversation without making an argument. I think that's actually just a good discipline for us. If you haven't made a good case or given an argument, given a reason for your position, well, then you can't just assume it throughout the conversation by calling something by a certain name. I've just found that that's really helpful if I try to use the other person's language. I mean, we're already doing cross-cultural work here, two different worldviews are talking, right? In many cases,
right,
I'm talking with a utilitarian who has a very different moral framework than I do. And it's already like we're talking to someone in a foreign country or with a foreign language. And so it makes it even harder if we use terms that are special to us. I mean, this is another reason why, or another example of this might be, should we use arguments from the Bible when we're talking to somebody who doesn't believe in the Bible? I think it's best to use their framework and their worldview until it becomes clear to both of us in the conversation that their framework or worldview isn't able to explain some of the shared beliefs that we have. Like if we have a shared belief in equal rights, and we find that a materialist view of the universe can't explain equal rights or human value or why certain behaviors are wrong, like rape, for example. Why is that wrong? If a materialist view comes up short when we ask it to explain those realities, well, then now that's a good time to bring up the biblical worldview or the view of Jesus on those things. And now the person, I think, is going to be more likely to be interested in Jesus. Now he might actually be a solution to a problem and not just a religious figure that you have a kind of a club that you go to on Sunday and it's centered around this religious figure. No, now Jesus is very real in the conversation. So I think I definitely want to get, as a Christian, I want to get to that point. But I many times will start with science and philosophy, and I know you folks at Life Training Institute take the same approach. We start with science and philosophical arguments that are based on something that people of many different worldviews can appreciate and tie into from the beginning.
We're about coming up to our halfway point for the interview. Again, if you have any questions for my guest, Steve Wagner, you can call in at 646-668-8597. Once again, that number is 646-668-8597. And if I don't get any callers, then I'll have plenty of questions for Steve. But if you have questions for him, please don't hesitate to call in. So your book, Common Ground Without Compromise, what was it that kind of inspired you to write a book on this topic?
Well, let me just say before, I just want to make sure we don't forget during our time together here, Clinton, if people go and Google my book and, or maybe they go to Amazon to find it, what they'll find is some used copies because the book is currently out of print and it was published in 2008. But I was just looking at it this evening and was pleased to see that many of the examples that I put in the book are durable. They aren't time sensitive, if you will. So I think people will be able to get a lot out of the book. It is available right now for free through the website that's devoted to the book, commongroundbook.com, commongroundbook.com. That takes people to a landing page, and the first link on the page says free book offer. If you click on that, there's actually a way that you can get an ebook version of the book for free. So I'd invite anyone who's listening to take me up on that offer.
Actually, I did have a note here to talk about the free offer near the end, but that's okay. We can talk about it now. Definitely, I would encourage that as well. I actually did get the book for free before I picked up a physical copy myself. Yeah, are there any plans?
So I put off your question, Clinton. So what? Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, that's okay. Just real quick before we return to the question, are there any plans to turn your book into like an ebook that they could upload to their Kindle or something?
I do have plans to do that, but I don't have a date of arrival on that. It's something that I've had on my list to do for a while. So I'm hoping. Soon that people can put on their Kindle. I'm hoping also to have an audio book version before too long. So people should definitely contact me via the if they go to that page, commongroundbook.com, or if they go to Justice for All's website, jfaweb.org, they can send me a note and let me know that they really want one of those versions of the book. That'll maybe give me an extra dose of motivation. I'm eager to do it. I just have a lot of things on my plate. So.
Yeah, I certainly know how that goes. To return to the question then, it's just I was just curious on what inspired you to write your book.
So I was mentored by Scott Klusendorf at Stand to Reason, and then Scott created the Life Training Institute, and I stayed on at Stand to Reason at that time. But I, at that time, very much just wanted to increase the number of people that heard good reasons for the pro-life position. I wanted to train Christians to make a good case in the public square, and I wanted to see people, I guess more people hear those arguments. And I didn't feel like there was any need for any more material to be created. It took me about 5 years or so before I felt like I had something to contribute to the pro-life literature. And this book actually is a little bit unique in that it's meant to be a letter to pro-choice and pro-life people. It's meant to be a book for both groups. So I wrote it very purposely as something that a pro-life person could give to a pro-choice person and use to start a conversation, or they could take one of the questions and share it with a pro-choice person in hopes of creating a better conversation or to start a conversation with that person. But really the genesis of the book was that I spent, starting in 2002, and especially in 2002, I went to my first Justice for All exhibit and talked to a lot of pro-choice people. And that started me down a certain path where I developed a passion for getting these arguments, not just in front of pro-life people, but actually having conversations with pro-choice people. And so I think it was in 2003, I went to a number of Justice for All exhibits, and then I was the main trainer for Justice for All for a few years, for really the five-year period from 2003 to 2008 when I published this book. And in that time, I spent a lot of time talking with pro-choice people, and that's what produced the book. Because when you go talk to pro-choice people, you find that you have to do something different. You can't just give them the pro-life argument. You're going to have to try to agree with them and try to understand them and try to partner with them as a co-laborer in finding the truth. And so the ideas about common ground were really born out of that field research, if you will, or this that time in the field. And our team still goes out on campus. I was just out at the University of Oklahoma 2 weeks ago. It's still our passion to go find people who disagree and create good dialogue with them in hopes that they'll come to have a more true perspective on the unborn child and women in distress and on abortion.
The subtitle of your book is 25 Questions to Create Dialogue on Abortion. So a lot of these questions, as I was looking back through your book to prepare for the interview tonight, a lot of these questions I can see are questions that we can find common ground with pro-choice people. But are all of the questions that we will definitely have common ground on, or are they just more to get a dialogue going?
That's a great question. These are 25 questions that I thought have a better chance at helping us find common ground. They are certainly not foolproof. Some people might hear one of the questions and not agree with you. You know, I've asked people, do you think abortion should be legal in the 35th week? And they say yes. Well, okay, now it didn't help us find common ground, right? I've asked people if they think abortion is okay when it's being used as birth control. And they'll say, I'm against it for myself, but we can't make it illegal for that reason. Okay, well, I have a little bit of common ground with them on being against it being used as birth control, but we don't have common ground on the legality legality part of that. So, I think these questions are, as Tim Brom at the Equal Rights Institute might say, they're sort of high probability play. You know, it's the sort of question that you're more likely to get common ground with, but I wouldn't say that it's a certainty. Some of the questions, very common that people will agree with us or will agree with them, but some are more, some of them are more food for thought, where they can lead to productive discussion, even if people don't agree right off the bat. The question about Down syndrome is like that. You know, I think people are, I don't know if everybody's against having abortion be legal to deal with Down syndrome, but a lot of people are really fond of Down syndrome, people with Down syndrome. So we can explore that with them because there's this sort of ambivalence or, you know, two sides to it for a lot of people. They're not going to be one-dimensional, and I think that's maybe a big part of this book. I don't think most people are one-dimensional. All pro-life or all pro-choice fit the stereotypes, fit into the categories that are on that maybe on TV or something.
Actually, the question about Down syndrome has become a little bit more poignant recently because there's an article that made the rounds on social media about how, I want to say it was the Netherlands, but there was an article about how they're claiming that they've almost eliminated Down syndrome. But the way that
Iceland. I think Iceland, I think.
Was it Iceland? Okay, yeah. I think that sounds right. That people in Iceland had basically eliminated Down syndrome, but the way they've done that is that almost 100% of babies conceived with Down syndrome have been aborted. So that was kind of a misleading headline that they gave to that article.
Right. Right. And but see, you know, it's interesting when you get into that issue with people, I think the more questions we can ask, the more common ground we can find, and maybe we don't agree on whether it should be legal or not. But I really want to help people start to develop an affection for human beings, both those who are born already and those who are yet to be born. And so when we talk about, whether Down syndrome is a good reason, you know, whether we want to eradicate Down syndrome and whether if that means eradicating, you know, human beings, and what does that mean for kids with Down syndrome now? You know, what is that? How does that reflect on the value of their lives? Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot there, even if we don't have common ground on whether it should be legal or not. I think that brings up an important point, though, Clinton, that the more questions that we ask about these things, specific circumstances surrounding the abortion, like the diagnosis of Down syndrome, for example, specific times of the pregnancy, first trimester, second trimester, third trimester, or maybe even more specific, the first 7 weeks from fertilization, you know, that sort of thing. The more specific we can be in our questions, the more helpful it's going to be to the conversation. What I've found is if we ask those specific questions, we find all sorts of common ground because we realize people are not all – they aren't the stereotypes. Actually, the stereotypes, the prejudices that we have built up, the baggage that we put onto this topic, you know, there's these pro-life and pro-choice camps. That's all not really true. People aren't like that. People are – I like to say people are weird. You know, they have a whole kind of complex set of mismatched ideas. And they may be confused, or they may just not have thought through all of them, or they may not have put them together into an integrated whole, or a coherent whole, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I would like to talk about some of the questions in your book in a moment, but one interesting piece of common ground that I've discovered that we can find with academic philosophers is regarding bodily rights arguments. I recently wrote an article on secular pro-life responding to Gina Resenin, who I mentioned at the beginning. I wrote an article responding to one of his for a bioethics journal. I interacted with him a little bit in the comments section of an article written on a bioethics website. And he wrote an article about bodily rights and how many philosophers like Judith Jarvis Thompson, David Boonin, etc., actually would say that even though a woman they believe has a right to an abortion because bodily rights would grant her that right to an abortion, that right to an abortion does not guarantee the right to a dead baby. That if you can remove the unborn embryo or fetus safely without killing him, such as to place him into an artificial environment like an artificial womb, well, then that right to an abortion is just a right to removal. It's not a right to the death of the embryo or fetus. So I found that as kind of an interesting. Now, Resenin doesn't believe along those lines. He actually believes that we do have the right to a dead fetus also. But he was talking about how many philosophers actually don't believe we have the right to a dead fetus, just a right to the removal of the fetus or embryo. So I thought that was a little bit of an interesting piece of common ground that we can actually find with many pro-choice philosophers.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. Now, of course, with Boonin, he doesn't believe that the early fetus is a human being with equal rights to you and me. But so he would have another reason to be, you know, he might bring that into the conversation. But I do think that's interesting, that especially for those who do believe that the unborn is a human being biologically, and then those who even might say it's a person from fertilization. That's an important set of common ground ideas to point out, and I do think the bodily rights arguments can help draw that out. That's interesting.
Okay, so I'd like to go through your book and just talk about some of these questions here, as many as we have time for. You spend a few chapters talking about why we should find common ground, how the abortion conversation is an important one, not one to just treat lightly like a game, and it's not a battle like a war, that kind of thing. But then you start talking about the questions, and you separate the questions, and you kind of group them all together and separate them by chapters. This first one, we kind of touched on a little bit, is what do you think about late-term abortion? And that is something that I find often, is that's one of the main things we can find as common ground with many abortion choice advocates, is that at least most people that I've talked to, and I'm sure most people you've talked to as well, would believe that abortions in the first trimester, there's nothing wrong with them, but there is something wrong in the later trimester. And I think it's more because they have this kind of emotional reaction to it, because it appears more human at the late term than it does at the early term. And I think most people have this instinctual feeling that we should cut it off around viability. So they would say probably about halfway through the second trimester is where we should cut it off, because then the fetus is capable of surviving outside of the uterus on its own.
Yeah, I think I think you're right that many pro-choice people have this sort of they have a number of different reasons why they might pick a line of viability or say that they're against late-term abortion, even to the point that they think it should not be legal. And it's pretty common for people to say that. I think one conversation I had at the University of Kansas that sort of brought out the importance of this question was we had a poll that just said, should abortion remain legal? And I had two young women signing the yes side, one signing the no side. And I asked one of them a question. And in the course of the conversation, I asked a whole lot of questions of both of them. But early in the conversation, one of them looked up and said, "Hey, sister, what are you writing?" And then she looked at me and said, "She really is my sister." And we began to talk, and I asked them both, "Do you think abortion should be legal late in the pregnancy?" They both were against that. And it turned out the woman that said abortion should remain legal said it should only remain legal early in the pregnancy using RU486, no surgical abortion, and only in the case of rape. And I think she also said in the case of the life of the mother. The person who thought abortion should not be legal thought it should not be legal except early in the pregnancy for the case of rape. And I think, I think life of the mother was a concern for her too. And I think she even said, I can't remember if she said RU486, but she definitely said early in the pregnancy. So these two women signed opposite sides of the poll, but actually believed almost exactly the same thing about abortion. And one of the reasons that we use that general question for the poll is just because it gets people to stop. But if I could do a more complicated question and get just as many people to stop, I would, because most people don't fit into these really simple categories, yes or no. In fact, we did a free speech board at the university, at Oklahoma State University on election day last November. And on one side, we have a straw poll about the presidential election. And we started conversations about abortion using that straw poll. And on the other side, we put all the different times when someone could get an abortion, I think we had each of the trimesters, and then we had a number of different circumstances for which someone could, or in which someone would be wanting to get an abortion, and people got to choose whether they thought that should be legal or not in each of those cases. And that was a very interesting way to start the conversation. You get a better sense for the person's perspective. You can find more common ground. But it's so complicated. You look at that free speech board. People can see it on our website at the Oklahoma State event in November 2016. You can see in those photos, you can see this free speech board is very complicated. It's like overwhelming to people to see it. But it is probably more representative of what a lot of people actually think.
Do you remember why the woman who was signing the yes, it should remain legal side said it should only be done with RU486?
I don't remember the reason. I just remember that she was very clear that she did not believe in surgical abortion. And that conversation actually ended. Say again?
Oh, no, I was just going to say I find that interesting that she would oppose surgical abortion in that case.
Yeah, and it might have been because of the way surgical abortion looks. I don't know. Or maybe it just was – maybe she was concerned about the health of women when they go through a surgical abortion. Sometimes that's a concern. But see, these are all things you could explore in the conversation. Many pro-life advocates just assume if somebody thinks abortion should not be legal, it's because the unborn's a human being. Well, no, actually, many people who think abortion should not be legal in the third trimester believe that because they think it's bad for women. So it could be a point of common ground about third trimester abortion, it should not be legal. But then when we get into the reasons, the why do you believe that, we might not have common ground. But it might be that they think it's a human being. I'd say that's the most common reason that people are against abortion in the third trimester. They think it's a human being just like us. And usually, like you said, I think it's because they look at a picture of the child and they think it looks like a child. They identify with it. They have that natural affection for it. And that's what's hard to demonstrate or hard for them to develop that affection for the early embryo.
The second question in your book is another one that is mentioned frequently, and that question is, should abortion be used as a form of birth control? And this is something that I hear often from abortion choice advocates, is that they would say that no, it shouldn't be used as birth control. In fact, they'll often bring that up just organically. I usually don't even have to ask. They'll just say, you know, yeah, I think abortion should be legal. I don't think it should be used as like birth control or something, but I think the option should at least be there if she needs it. So they usually bring it up without any prompting from what I've seen. And this is something that Planned Parenthood used to actually say as well. They printed a brochure back in the 40s or 50s in which they had like a frequently asked questions section. And it said, is abortion birth control? And they said, no, because abortion ends the life of a baby after it begins. So even Planned Parenthood, before abortion became legal, recognized that abortion was not a form of birth control. And I think many women today who support abortion would also say that it shouldn't be used merely as birth control as well.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It's been your experience that this is also another one that we can find a lot of common ground with pro-choice people on?
Well, I think you're talking about the question on birth control, abortion as birth control. Yeah, I've just heard a lot of people over the years say things of their own accord like this. I don't think that abortion should be used as birth control. That's really what led to me putting the question in the book. I have asked people this question. I think the liability with this question is that they don't think women should use it as birth control, but they think it should be legal to be used as birth control. A lot of people would say that. And you have to, of course, define what do you mean by using abortion as birth control. I define it in the book as having 5, 10, 15, 20 abortions, you know, using it over and over and over. And many people will say that's morally objectionable. They would not want to do that. But then when you ask, should it be legal in that case, then they're going to be much more reluctant to say abortion should not be legal in that case.
Yeah, you actually separate the morality from the legality in your book as well. And so, yes, that's definitely an important distinction to keep in mind, is that even if someone opposes abortion morally, it doesn't necessarily mean they think that it should be illegal.
That's right. And many times people will say, I'm against it, or I think it's wrong, or I think it's bad. And I want to explore why do they think it's bad. But sometimes I focus on the legality, whether they think it should be legal, because it gives me a good diagnostic for really what do they really believe about abortion? Is it the killing of an innocent human being? Because when do we keep that legal? When do we keep the killing of an innocent human being legal, especially when it's being chosen on an elective basis?
The third question then, do you believe men should have the choice to abort their fetuses, is one that I'm sure a lot of, well, because obviously pro-life people would say, well, no, we don't think anyone should be able to have the choice to abort the fetus. But I know a lot of abortion choice people, especially women, would say, no, they shouldn't. and a lot of the pro-choice men will kind of agree with them, I think, sometimes to fall in line. But also, just because it's always seen as a woman's issue, and that's the woman's choice because she's the one that's pregnant, when, of course, as a lot of pro-life people teach, and I know JFA talks about this in their seminars as well, that abortion does affect men as well. And so the men in this question are often brushed away to the side because it's seen as a woman's issue, not as a man's issue, or not even as a couple's issue.
Yeah, well, this is sort of a clever way to try to bring up the topic of fetal homicide, or when someone kills a pregnant woman and the fetus. Many times that's dealt with as a double homicide. I give some examples of that in the book. I think many people remember the Scott Peterson case as sort of an example in the news, or that was in the news a while back. I think, you know, I haven't asked this question to a lot of people recently, but I think asking questions about, you know, should we kill the fetus who's wanted? Almost nobody believes that that's a good thing. And this draws out the important distinction between wanted and unwanted fetuses or embryos. We treat them very differently in our society. And the Justice for All exhibit that we built in 2000, which people can see at our website, jfaweb.org/exhibits, that original exhibit that we built, the third and fourth panel brought out this point. You know, we treat wanted unborn children one way. We give them surgeries. We treat them as patients. We treat unwanted unborn children a different way. I think the point of this question was to try to help people focus in on those wanted unborn children. We treat them as real human beings. And if this person I'm talking to is pro-choice, I want to know if they at least recognize the humanity of this unborn child, if the mother believes it's human, or if the mother cares about it. And many times I think they do. They actually have this interesting approach to the topic that whatever the woman believes about it makes it so. Now, I don't think that's a good argument, but it's an interesting thing to explore.
Now, I'd like to skip ahead a little bit to the 13th question in the book. The question being, do you believe what is removed during an abortion is a new whole organism of the human species? I've had a number of conversations on college campuses through JFA and through other organizations that I've volunteered with or partnered with. And for the most part, and this is something that JFA teaches as well, that if someone seems to be denying the humanity of the unborn organism, then what they're really doing, and they don't realize it, is that they're actually denying the personhood. But once we talk about the science of embryology, most everyone is going to agree that it's a whole individual organism of the human species. I've gotten that on college campuses, and I think that's what a lot of people are doing. But it seems that when I have conversations through social media like Facebook, there are a lot of times that I actually have to defend the proposition that the unborn from fertilization are genetically distinct, individual, whole human beings. And occasionally I'll have someone try to argue against the scientific consensus. They'll argue that, well, you know, it's not the case that scientists are have a consensus on this question, that, you know, it's not scientifically sure that human life begins at fertilization. And so what's the, I guess, is this something you found through, because you've had a lot more conversations and discussions than I have. Based on all of the discussions you've had, do you find that it's fairly rare for someone to actually deny the biological humanity of the unborn? Or do you think that a lot of times they kind of use it as just kind of like a fallback if you respond to all of their other concerns? Or how do you find is kind of the, not really, I guess ordinary isn't really the right word for it, but the most, I guess the most common way of talking about this particular topic?
Well, I think I would put it maybe conversely to the way you put it a minute ago, that it's I have a better chance of getting common ground with the person about the biology, at least early on in the conversation, than I do getting common ground about personhood or whether the unborn has rights and value. It's maybe a lower bar they have to reach, or it's not as hard for them to agree with it, especially when they see how I'm cashing it out. I think some of the most difficult, or one of the most difficult parts of the conversation for many pro-life and pro-choice advocates is that pro-choice advocates many times think that we're saying more than we're trying to say. So I will make a case that the unborn is a living human organism, and the pro-choice advocate assumes that what that means to me is, therefore, the unborn is a person, have equal rights to us, and if the woman has bodily rights, they're not significant enough to trump the rights of the fetus. You know, they attach all of those other statements to me just saying it's a living human organism. And this is something that all of us do in communication, right? We attach baggage or extra assumptions to statements that people make, or we assume that they must mean this other thing because that's where they're going. That's what they're getting at. And I think that is a sort of a difficulty that plagues us as pro-life advocates when we're just trying to make a strictly biological case just so we can get a foundation. Okay, are we at least on the same page that this is – that the unborn is a living thing? You know, we just want to – is it a living human thing? Is it living human tissue? Is it a living human organism? We're just trying to get this biological foundation so that then we can have a reasonable philosophical discussion that has some, you know, at least these biological facts clarified for us.
Yeah.
And many times people sort of sense where you're headed. And if they have, you know, if you've had some training, they sense that you have more training than they do. And they then resist. And you'll hear people say things like, well, it's human, but it's not human. Or it's alive, but it's not living. I mean, I think I was at the University of Oklahoma I think this was something that I heard on that campus just 2 weeks ago. It was I wish I had a recording of it. Most pro-life advocates would laugh at it as incoherent. I saw it as the person trying to give me some information about, like, what they meant. Now, I had built a rapport and a context, a space in that conversation where the person could have the freedom to try to work these ideas out. I was not going to – I think they knew – the person knew it, and I was demonstrating it in everything they said. I was not going to step on what they said or try to get a zinger in there to try to help people see how foolish it is. They said, it's human, but it's not human. I mean, what could that possibly mean? No, I thought that. I said, no, that's really interesting that you would say that. And so, you know, and then I used that as a way to clarify. Well, let's see if we agree on biologically or biological facts first. And let's just stay there. You know, let's talk about my cheek cells. If I take cheek cells out of my cheek with a toothpick or a swab and give it to the doctor so he can put them on a slide and put them under the microscope and see if I have some kind of disease. Have I just, what is on the slide? Are those living things? Are they living things? Okay, good. Are they living human tissue? Okay, good. Are they living human organisms? You know, and then we can compare that to the embryo. It's very different. Of course, cheek cells are a functional part of my organism, but the unborn is not a functional part of anybody's organism. It's its own organism with its own functional parts. It's a whole rather than a part. And I think that can bring a lot of clarity to the conversation, but I don't want to give our listeners the impression that that is simple, or that we always find common ground on this point. I definitely have arguments with people, or you know, friendly arguments, where we're giving reasons back and forth about whether the unborn is a living human organism. That it's not a foregone conclusion or something that's obvious to people. But I will say, many times it's just getting the terms clear and figuring out how to talk the same language as the other person that's most of the work.
What would you have to say to someone who insists that all pro-choice people are baby killers and that we should use terms like pro-death in our conversations with them?
Well, it's interesting. All pro-choice people, that's a lot of people. And it seems like they're one thing that we can be certain of is they're very different. And their level of complicity, I don't know if that's the right word, but the level of being complicit in abortions in their community is going to be different from one person to the next. And whether they've had experience with abortion, whether they have a character that is that's very selfish, or a character that's very selfless, or you know, whether they think abortion is a necessary evil. I mean, all of these things are going to be different from person to person. So it's hard to make any generalizations about all pro-choice people. And I think many times pro-life advocates want to speak truth and say, if you're for abortion, you're for the killing of babies. I want that truth to be able to be heard by the person. So I want that to come out probably at a point in the conversation where we have enough rapport, where I can ask a question like, well, do you think then that abortion is actually the killing of a human being? And what do you think we should do about that? That to me is going to be, I think, much more powerful in the person's life to help them grapple with that truth, that abortion kills babies, than me saying to them they're baby killers when I don't even know them and I don't even know anything about their beliefs. When I've gone to people and given them the benefit of the doubt and believed that they love human beings, and they actually love women and they love babies, but maybe they don't think the unborn is a baby. You know, when I've given them that benefit of the doubt, I've found many times that people surprise me. They surprise me with how concerned they are about human beings and how open they are to our position, to hearing a good reason for our position. There's we have a Twitter feed called Seven Conversations that I would recommend to the listeners. We've written every post on that feed for the purpose of sharing with pro-choice people or pro-life people. It's just something that anybody can use to start a conversation. But one of my favorite posts on Seven Conversations is a little free speech board comment that was written on one of our free speech boards, and it makes essentially the point that I just made, but I think more beautifully. So I'd encourage people to go look for that post.
Well, once again, where can people go to find your book for free?
So they can go to commongroundbook.com, commongroundbook.com. And there's a link to a free book offer. They just have to fill out a form. And as I explain on that form, I send them the first part of the book. I cut the book into two halves. I send them the first part, and then if they send me an email telling me that they've had a conversation using that first part of the book, I'll send them the second part. So everything about the book for me, and really everything about Justice for All, is encouraging people to have conversations. So I decided to use my free book offer with that in mind. So you can get the first part of the book just by filling out the form. But the second part, you have to pay with a conversation, if you will. So.
Yeah, I think that's a great offer, obviously, because I take advantage of it myself back when I was still green as a pro-life advocate. So where can people find you online? Are there any other websites or books you'd like to plug while I have you here?
Sure. Well, Justice for All's website is JFA, Justice for All, JFAweb.org. So JFAWEB.org. There are many free resources there, including our Learn at Home program, which is something that people can do in 1 hour to become a better pro-life advocate. I'd encourage people to use the resources at Life Training Institute, the Case for Life website, and I think maybe the one recommendation that I'd like to leave the listeners with is a recommendation to bring Clinton out to speak. Clinton is just a delightful person. He's a good friend of mine, but I'm not saying this just because of that. It's really because every time Clinton comes on a JFA trip, he's a delight to be around. He's intelligent. He's got good things to share. I think you would be really happy to have him at any event speaking at your event. So that's my appeal to your listeners, Clinton, but I would say all those things also to you. I really enjoy being with you.
Well, thanks, Steve. The feeling is definitely mutual. That's all the time that we have for our show, and I'd like to thank you for listening. I know that the information here is incredibly important. And Steve, thank you again for coming on and allowing me to interview you.
Clint, it was great being with you. I had a great time. Thanks.
So if you enjoyed the interview, we would just ask that you share it around social media, rate and review us on our Facebook page as well as on iTunes. The information here today will definitely help people become a much better communicator of the pro-life position, especially if you go to commongroundbook.com to take advantage of the free book offer from Steve. Now, this is a weekly podcast, give or take, because obviously I've been missing a few weeks recently, but it's intended to be a weekly podcast. And I hope to get the weekly schedule back up and running here pretty soon. But it takes a lot of work to put together a podcast each week on top of all the other work that I do in the pro-life movement. As Greg Cunningham of Center for Bioethical Reform says, there are more people working full-time to kill unborn babies than there are people working full-time to save them. I subsist off of donations from financial supporters. People like you keep me being able to do the work that I do. If you like what we're doing with this podcast and would like to support my work as a full-time pro-life advocate, you can go to www.prolifetraining.com, which is the Life Training Institute website, and click on Donate in the menu on the top. You can give a one-time gift or you can give a monthly gift. Just be sure to put my name in the notes section so that Life Training Institute knows to put your donation into my account. And if you'd like to donate to this podcast specifically, you can also indicate that in the notes section. And donations are also tax deductible. We've kind of gotten away from the weekly schedule, and like I said, I hope to get back onto it. So not really a next week's topic to announce, just that, like I said, we still have about 3 episodes I still have to do post-production on to get produced in post-production and then to put live on the website. And so we have a couple of episodes on bodily rights coming up, as well as we're going to start talking about personhood and how philosophers talk about personhood. And I think we're going to start with Marianne Warren's conception of personhood from her essay on the moral and legal status of abortion. And we're also going to be bringing on Nancy Piercy to talk about a book that she has releasing in January, among some other interviews that we're setting up. So once again, I'd like to thank you for joining me, and thank Steve as well for the interview, and we will see you next time.